Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRTLP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime at kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. I'm your host. Thank you for tuning in. You might have seen the famous photo. If you're old enough, you might remember it. The image shows an American helicopter incongruously perched atop the roof of an elevator shaft of a Saigon apartment building, with people lined up on a sloping ladder, backlit by the sky, hoping to board. The location is commonly misidentified as the roof of the U.S. Embassy, but regardless, it shows the final hours of the evacuation of U.S. citizens, South Vietnamese allies, and others from what was at the time still South Vietnam, on the day that its capital, Saigon, fell to the North Vietnamese Army and to the North's allies of the South at the end of the Vietnam War. As we call it the Vietnam War, and in Vietnam they call it the American War. When so many people were leaving Saigon, a few Americans chose to stay behind. Today's guest is one of them, Claudia Critch, a retired teacher who lives in Davis. She kept a journal of her experience, and it's the basis of her new book, Those Who Stayed, A Vietnam Diary. She's here with us today on Davisville, and will speak April 30th at the Davis Library at 6 p.m., 50 years to the day from the end of the war. Claudia, thank you for joining us today by Zoom.
Thank you.
I feel I need to tell a little bit about the history of the Vietnam War because it was a half century ago. It had many aspects. It's a complex history. Your book focuses on 1975, the end of the war between the northern and the southern parts of Vietnam. They had become two parts in 1954 after Vietnam's war for independence from French colonial rule. In the Vietnam War, the United States took the side of the non-communist South Vietnam against the communist North Vietnam and its allies, known as the Viet Cong. During the decade of overt U.S. military involvement, more than 58,000 U.S. service members died or went missing, and the conflict over the war tore at America back home. The war was a huge moment in the life of the United States, and of course, it was much more consequential in Vietnam. So, Claudia, you were there because you were co-director of the American Friends Service Committee Medical Humanitarian Program in Vietnam from 1973 until 1975. Could you tell us where you were and what the work involved?
Our program was based in a small town called Quang Ai in central Vietnam, not too far from Da Nang. And we ran a large physical rehabilitation center, making artificial limbs, crutches, wheelchairs, and so on for injured civilians, only civilians. The South Vietnamese government had other rehab centers for soldiers, but they had none for civilians. And AFSC's role was to set up a program and then ideally turn it over to the government and leave. That's what they do around the world. But in this case, the old government had no interest in it at all. It's actually still functioning right now. The new government did take it over.
So by the new government, you mean the one that took over after April 1975?
The current government ever
Yeah.
since the war ended. We also had two people stationed in Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City. And they helped with logistics. We would fly back and forth to get supplies or meet with officials. We also did do quite a bit of journalism and reporting, had articles published in journals in the United States, and had visitors. Among them, Pete McCloskey once came to visit in a really important congressional delegation. Their job was to decide whether or not to continue funding the war. This was very near the end. And even though some members of the delegation wanted to continue to fund it, Pete McCloskey and others won the argument. Funding ended. And that was a large part of the reason why the war finally ended. It was supposed to have ended in December of 72 with the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, for which Kissinger and Lê Duc Thọ got the Nobel Peace Prize, but it didn't end. It was not true. And in fact, the Vietnamese half of that, Lê Duc Thọ, refused the award. And Kissinger wouldn't go to the ceremony because he was concerned about the protests. So there was a lot of protesting going on in America.
Yeah, and we should mention a few things. Kissinger was Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, and was involved in the negotiations that led to the Paris Peace Accords. And the U.S. troops were gone by early 73 before you arrived there. But before we get into that, I just want to mention the Friends, often known as the Quakers, right? And so this is something that the denomination of the church does, is do service work like this throughout the world.
Without proselytizing, I might add, not missionaries.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, the point is you're there to do service. In this case, you were to help the civilians there. All right, so you went over in 73. Now, the reason I mention that is because at that point, the US had withdrawn its military. At one point, I think we had over 500,000 soldiers there. Does that mean then that where you were, you pretty much didn't see US soldiers? They were largely gone by then, right? Who you worked with, the Vietnamese, right?
I never saw. There were some called contractors. Now, some soldiers had changed their clothing and their definition and were contractors, but not where we lived. They would have been in Saigon. The only American presence besides us in our town was a missionary family, the Mennonite Central Committee, and the CIA and USAID people. And they were in one compound by themselves.
Okay.
But no soldiers.
Now you had gone to college. You had graduated by the time you went over. What made you want to go to Vietnam to do this work?
Well, since I graduated from undergraduate college in 1969, the Vietnam War was very important, known to everybody. Young men were being drafted, which I think is an enormous, important aspect of that war. And of course, they didn't want to go. Some wanted to go, but many did not. And so that was a huge issue. And we women were fully aware of it, even though we weren't being drafted. I was very much against the war, had been in high school. We felt pretty helpless, didn't know what to do. So I went there to be useful, but I have to admit, I also went there because it was exotic and the war was over, except that the war was not over. My images of what would happen there were quite different from what I actually encountered. My husband, Keith Brinton, had worked with the same program for 3.5 years before we met. And then we were asked to go as co-directors together. So we went back together. Yeah, it was quite a surprise. It was definitely not what I thought.
Could you elaborate on that? Like, what did you expect, and then what did you see?
I guess I thought there would be, I didn't know it would be that poor. I didn't know that I would hear the war sounds and see the tanks and the trucks and hear the bombing, hear the artillery all the time in our town, not in Saigon. I just wasn't expecting that. I didn't know that we could not. We lived very near the beach, but we couldn't go because the area between us and the beach was disputed, meaning it was pretty much held by the other side, not the South Vietnamese side. And so it wasn't safe to go there. While we were there, some of our members were kidnapped, sort of by accident, by the so-called communist side. And we were always had to be careful about that. They came back, but the danger, just the danger from landmines, meant we were very constricted in where we could go.
Yeah. One of the themes I took from your book is the ambiguity. I mean, the big subject obviously is the war and the fight for Vietnam, basically. But the ambiguity, and you say this early on, you talked about how one could never be sure which side one was interacting with. And this is when you're going about just helping people. But how did you learn to work in that environment? I mean, we can always wonder around us who's who, but
Yeah.
you're in a war zone, so that's a whole different calculation.
We absolutely wondered who's who. Even people we thought were leaning toward it was called the liberation side. There were some clues. If, for example, we had journalists come to our rehab center to interview patients, one was Fox Butterfield of the New York Times. I'll never forget that one. And he interviewed many, many, many patients, and every last one of them said, they were injured by the Americans because they stepped on landmines, or it was not the Americans, but the South Vietnamese supported by the Americans. And one of his mistakes was his interpreter used the word Viet Cong, and that was like a signal. If somebody used the word Viet Cong, you figured they were anti-communist. If they used the word Liberation Front, you figured they were at least sympathetic to the other side. It was very complicated, all the terminology. I remember one of our workers who was a very wry sort of older man, and we never did figure out his politics. Don't know it to this day. And others, to our surprise, later on, we learned were actively involved with the liberation side or the so-called Viet Cong. There was no way to know. You had to tiptoe around and find out. Some people, like my language tutor, told me about herself when she told me how her husband had died while I was there working with her. And he was a liberation poet. His job was to write poetry, not carry a gun. Can you imagine? Try that in our military. Well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are some. I have no idea.
I've not heard of them, but it's not to say there aren't people in the military who write poetry.
Exactly.
Okay, and it's pretty clear. I mean, your sympathies clearly were with, you're saying, the liberation side. And now, was that something that you came over there with, or was that a view that developed as you were there?
I was anti-war before I went. I had a very strong feeling that war was not accomplishing anything and that we Americans had no business bombing the living daylights out of this small country in Asia that very few people could find on the map. When I got there, no, I'd say I was reasonably neutral when I got there, trying to figure it out, but it was obvious all the war was being carried out by the South Vietnamese. They had the money, they had the supplies, they had the backers, and we didn't see any North Vietnamese that we could recognize, but we saw the Viet Cong or liberation people, and they used more clever means. For example, one of my favorite things was, we learned this later, of course, hanging baskets of human excrement in trees to attract the heat-seeking missiles from the South Vietnamese airplanes. So the war looked very one-sided when we were there. We became very aware of corruption. Matter of fact, we were robbed by our local chief of police's friends. I'm simplifying the story, but it's in the book. And we knew there was corruption. We knew that the best way to get anything done was to bribe, which we did not do. So the ordinary people who just wanted the war to be over, basically support were anti the South Vietnamese. Not everybody, obviously, but out where we were in the countryside, they were. Saigon, whole different story. I'm sure the vast majority were pro-American. But it was clear that the war was hurting the people in the towns that where we were.
So let's move on to Saigon because that was the city that captured the world's attention when it changed hands in 75. And now you left the area of the north as the Northern Army was coming in because, well, for a variety of reasons, but you didn't want to repeat that in Saigon. You wanted to stay there and see what happened, basically, right? That's why you stayed.
Correct. Yeah. We fled and were very ashamed of ourselves, really, because we had tried hard all the time. The program was there for years to have a line between us and American authorities, American government authorities. We were a neutral organization. But when it was clear that Quang Ai was going to fall, as they say, we joined the panic and we left. And then we regretted it pretty quickly after that. And decided not to do it again. We also had a very pretty strong suspicion that one of the reasons the American embassy and CIA wanted all the Americans out was so we could not report on what was going to happen. Mind you, even though all the Americans left, except about a dozen of us, all the French people stayed. There had to be at least 2,000. The Indian people stayed. I mean, nobody panicked but the Americans. And we decided, since we had friends who were like French journalists and Italian journalists, they stayed, and we just decided we would stay too.
And now you're talking about Saigon in that case. You left the North. I mean, there were a lot of stories which you dismiss in the book, essentially, warnings about what might happen. And as you point out, didn't happen. But of course, right next door in Cambodia, a very different country, when the Khmer Rouge took over, there really was a tremendous oppression of the
Yeah.
people. So, in a time of war, when you're not sure what to expect, I can see why you would think. We better leave this town. We don't know what's going to happen, and it could be grim.
Yeah, for sure. As I imagine you know, within the short couple of months when we were still there, refugees began fleeing from Cambodia to Vietnam and were being kicked out. Anybody of Vietnamese origin, anybody with Vietnamese ties was being kicked out. And when I remember coming back and people would say, I don't get it. Cambodia was communist, Vietnam was communist. Why are they fighting? Well, the answer is communist doesn't mean anything really. I mean, first of all, Vietnam was socialist by self-definition, and Cambodia was a dictatorship. So Cambodia, as you know, tried to get rid of all of the educated, the elite, sent them out to the countryside, chopped off the heads of any organizations that might be, well, run the government. This is not as a dictatorship.
Yeah, we'll do a quick station ID. We are talking with Claudia Critch. She is a retired teacher in Davis, but we're talking because she's written a book called Those Who Stayed, A Vietnam Diary. And it's based on her journal when she stayed in Saigon when the city, it's now known as Ho Chi Minh City, when it changed hands in 1975 at the end of what we call the Vietnam War. I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM in Davis, California.
I think you mentioned the threats, the propaganda. There was the panic among the Vietnamese was enormously caused by South Vietnamese and US propaganda that there would be a bloodbath. That was the term. It's still in use. There was a bloodbath. It was never defined, but there wasn't a bloodbath. There were billboards and news clips saying if the commies take over, men can't have long hair, women can't have long fingernails, they will be raped, they'll be murdered, they'll be hung, and so on and so forth. And no, there was no bloodbath. Now, in individual provinces, different things happened, but on a general level, no, it just
Yeah.
wasn't true.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the advantages of looking at something like this from 50 years later. You can look back and say, well, what did happen? I'd like you to talk a little bit about Saigon right before April 30th and then what you saw on the day of. You were living in Saigon at that point, you and your husband and some others. What did you see in Saigon as it changed hands?
When we first got there, a couple of months before, we kept track. BBC was our main news source, and province after province changed hands, almost always peacefully. Not that there wasn't fighting, but usually the fighting was on the outside of the town. Then it got closer and closer and closer, and it became obvious that Saigon was very iffy. Saigon officials, government officials, military people started leaving. And abandoning their positions, even in government. On the last couple of days, there was a transfer of power within the government, ending with Big Minh, had been a president a long time earlier, and he took over the South Vietnamese government for one day and handled the surrender. That was his plan. He also, now am I remembering this correctly? He also was the one who ordered the American government officials to leave.
Yes, that's in your book. You said that he, I think right at the end of April, he ordered Americans out.
Yeah, which was pretty amazing. It's not that we did leave intentionally, but not we personally, but the American government. But the last few remaining people were kicked out by our own the side that we supported. It was very scary. The last couple of days, especially the last day, very loud booms, and in the sky were helicopters and fighter jets, and there was shooting at them. And the BBC reported that the shooting at them was actually the South Vietnamese soldiers who were angry. They had loads of ammunition. I mean, they were shooting randomly the entire time I was there. They just had plenty of ammunition from the USA. And that last night was very frightening. It was our little teeny house was half uncovered, as many houses were. So it was loud. There was a tin roof. We sandbagged the front of the house, but it was sort of silly. It wasn't really going to do any good.
And there's more detail in the book than we could ever get into here, but could you give us just a sense of what you saw in the next few days? You saw quite a change in the city.
Oh yeah, it was overnight. It was quite literally overnight. on the night of April 29th, we were petrified. We were in our house. We couldn't eat or drink. We were too scared. The morning of the 30th, a friend came with a Jeep, and we piled in, and we all went to the local Buddhist university, or not local, the Saigon Buddhist University called Vang Han. And there we saw a lot of action. The students had gotten organized, I don't know when, and they were collecting ammunition. They were issuing ID cards. Hundreds of soldiers had already turned themselves in, or were turning themselves in. These are South Vietnamese soldiers. They were sometimes dressed in their underwear or shorts, had thrown off their uniforms, gotten rid of their guns, and surrendered. But the funny part was, at that point where I was, there was nobody they were surrendering to. They were coming to give their supplies to students. And the students then armed themselves. They didn't particularly use the guns, but it made them look official. We were not at the downtown gate or to the palace where news people were watching the more dramatic tanks that rolled right up to the palace. I must say, after that, the palace was completely accessible. The barbed wire was gone, the barriers were gone. It was a very strange thing. But anyway, back where we were, we got there in the morning, and it wasn't till about 4 p.m. that we saw troops and tanks coming in on our street. The crowds were huge. People were celebrating. I'm not going to claim that everybody in Saigon was delighted, but a lot of people were. They didn't care who the government was. They couldn't believe there was going to be peace, that it was over. And then we saw so many cases of family members being reunited, relatives who'd gone from the north, who had gone south in 1954, meeting relatives who had come down now from the north. Sometimes it was complicated, like a husband or a wife had waited 20 years, but the other half of that relationship had gotten married again. It was a time warp. It was so strange. People had gotten, had one child 20 years ago or before, and then had another one 18 years later and 20 years later. But the vast majority of people were happy and excited and just euphoric. And there were some, not, but I didn't meet any of them.
Well, I suppose the ones who weren't happy probably weren't out on the street, at least not,
Exactly.
at least they
Yeah,
weren't going to
yeah.
express their unhappiness because they would be worried about that.
Yeah. I should mention that we, all of us in American Friends Service Committee and also with Mennonite Central Committee, we all spoke Vietnamese. We had to. Where we lived in Quang Ai, nobody spoke English and almost nobody spoke French. The news people generally did not speak Vietnamese. That was a huge distinction. And a lot of people asked us for information, wanted us to tell them what was going on because they could talk to us. And we did have outside information like BBC.
Well, and you mentioned this in early detail in your book as well, that when you were farther north, you dress and ate and live locally. So that's going to bring you closer, I think, to the community. You and your husband left Vietnam in early July 1975. What told you it was time to go?
We did leave. It was the 4th of July. We left because we were superfluous at that point. The work we had been doing, we could not continue. We couldn't get back to where our rehab center was. We couldn't bring in any money to help support that work because there were no ties between the US and Vietnam. And basically, we were running out of money and running out of things to do, and we're just not needed. I was also pregnant and wanted to carry on with that in America and instead of burdening anybody in Vietnam with that. And basically, it was time to go. People have asked us, well, how did you get out over the many years since then? And the answer was Air France. We simply got on a list of people trying to leave, and eventually our names came up and we left. We were the first American civilians to, well, I think we might have been the first Americans to leave Saigon after the end of the war. Shortly thereafter, the rest of our team left, and most Americans left because it was time for the Vietnamese to be in charge of their own country.
We have just a few minutes left. But one thing I want to ask you about is you've had an eventful life and you've lived half a century since then. In Davis, among other things, you taught music at Willard Elementary. You won the Harmony in Our Lives Award in 2010, I think it was, for that. Point is, that's a very different life, Davis 2020s, 2010s, than Vietnam was in the mid 70s with that war going on, this big change occurring all around you. I'm wondering how that has shaped your life, that experience, and I'm wondering if your views have changed on anything relative to that war since then.
My views on war have not changed in the least. I understand World War II. My father was in World War II. That was perhaps defensible or clearly defensible against Hitler and Mussolini and Franco. But creating wars, which we do in our country, and it's being threatened right now to our immediate neighbors, protest that. I will always continue to protest that. I've never changed. Vietnam kind of disappeared off the radar after 1975. We had no relationships with them. We couldn't get in touch with our friends. They couldn't get in touch with us. We just focused on other things. And it took a long time. If we had, as a country, supported Vietnam, just as right now we're removing all the support, we're not doing it. The current government is removing support for poor African countries, for fighting HIV, for saving people in earthquakes and all that. Just that is what should be happening. That's the sign of a strong country and a strong democracy.
Your point is
And
to provide the aid is the sign of a strong country.
thank you.
Is, yeah,
Yes, to
okay.
provide the aid is what we should be doing. We have the wealth and we should be sharing it, and it's to our own advantage. So, no, I would say that I'm still as progressive. Is that the right word?
And you and again, it's a very different life here in Davis, I'm sure, than it was then. I'm just wondering if there's anything from that experience that you still have echoes of these days, in the face of a child, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but something that carries with you.
The sweetness. Well, if I could respond to that in terms of Vietnam, they drew a distinction back then between Americans and the American government. We were okay because we were not government. And that stays with me. I know that there's goodness, quote Anne Frank, in the heart of everyone. Although it's really hard to see. Really hard to see. I
Yeah.
also know that Vietnam is now just another country with its problems. The war has faded in their own memories. It's really, I think what sticks with me is that if you don't know history, if you don't study real history and learn history, you do it again.
Well, Claudia, you've contributed now to that history, at least to the Vietnam War, with your book, because you were there. I mean, this is first person material. So thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Bill.
We've been talking with Claudia Critch of Davis. She's written a book, Those Who Stayed: A Vietnam Diary. She's going to talk about it at the Davis Library, 6 p.m., I believe, but better check that, on April 30th. I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville, KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California. Thank you for listening.